Welcome, Bankless Nation, to a differently styled podcast on the Bankless feed. I want to welcome three guests onto this podcast as we discuss, deliberate, debate, and dissect the topics that we all find interesting. First up, some people are wary of society's trend towards gambling and financialization, but where some see moral hazard, this man sees opportunity. By day, he's on the couch scrolling crypto Twitter, and by night, well, he's still there. The only person on crypto Twitter actually having any fun, Andy8052, it's good to see you.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me. Also, sometimes on the day, I am playing golf.
He sometimes plays golf. Bringing up the middle, if you haven't seen his ass, you're not in the right circles. The person that did the impossible, somehow not having a single hater on Twitter, the pink-coated educator with glutinous glutes, the mega ass of mega ETH, 0x bread guy, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. That intro, I actually thought you were going to go to John, and I just had missed his ass picture. So, you know, maybe sometime in the future.
Yeah, you're the only one with an ass on Twitter right now. And then bringing up the rear, the crypto's chief lowercase r researcher, the man who will write a 90-page research paper over the weekend because it was fun. We've all read his long AF research papers only to conclude that nothing's real and we should all buy Bitcoin. John Charbonneau, how you doing?
Great to be back on. How's it going?
Pretty excited for this episode, guys. So the topics that we've got lined up for this week, the Ethereum pivot has a tagline. But what about ETH? Is ETH coming along for that? We want to talk about the death of long-tail layer twos. We're going to talk about a little bit of what Andy's doing in the trenches. And then we're going to finish off with one gorilla versus 100 men. A crucial question to this era of crypto Twitter. And I think actually this has just gone out to the internet broadly. First off, honored to have you guys here. I think everyone has been a podcaster in of their own right separately. So bring in these three podcasters to the table just to kind of go through the weekly meta. So let's start here. I'm going to start sharing my screen to a tweet that Haseeb tweeted out, which coincidentally was something that my partner Ryan Sean Adams also identified when we talked to the two recent executive directors, co-EDs of the EF. This idea of the Ethereum pivot's tagline, the tagline for the Ethereum pivot: scale the layer one, scale blobs, improve UX. Three easy to remember ideas. Seems like it lands a punch. And then Haseeb finishes off with a tweet here. If they can pull this off and buy back some credibility, this may be the beginning of the ETH revival. Let's see. Now, I think this topic was the subject between John and Brett and I last week when, Andy, you were a bit sick. Missed you having you back then. So maybe we can just pick off where that episode left. John, I'll throw this one to you. How do you feel about this tagline for ETH? On the scale of possible taglines, how do you feel about this one?
I love it. I mean, I'll give it a 10 out of 10. And I do agree with Steve's tweet there. Like, if they can pull this off and actually get back credibility on this, like, this would be a meaningful turn for me, both for Ethereum and for ETH as the asset, like, most likely to me. The one thing that I saw, like, as interesting on it, too, is, I don't know if I'm reading too much into this, but the ordering of it was scale the L1 before scale blobs, which was just an interesting note. And that, like, that is a nuance that I'm sure a lot of people would fight over if that, like, actually is the listed priorities. That would actually be my preference, is actually to focus more on scale in the layer one. But that was one of the things that I picked off as, like, really liking in there. And then throwing in the improve UX is, yeah, like, obviously Ethereum should be doing more of that. It's great. Mm-hmm.
Some people miss the blobs entirely, right? Like, I saw OXNGMI, famously the creator of DeFi Llama. He's like, so this is rugging the roll-up roadmap, right? Like, they missed that nuance of saying that, that goes towards, like, no one on the L1 uses blobs, right? The blobs are stored in the consensus layer. You literally can't even submit a transaction that utilizes blobs on mainnet with a wallet because the wallets don't support. So, like, it's not an L1 user thing. It cannot be an L1 user thing today. So that is explicitly for rollups. I personally think it should be deprioritized, but I think it's good to have some directional stuff there for L2s. I just don't see it as, like, a great value accretive thing, but it's good to have that signal there for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some people were responding to that tweet from 0xNGMI saying, look, Ethereum detractors, Ethereum haters will find a way to always just be negative about Ethereum. It's like, oh, like, we're going to scale blobs, but even the Ethereum haters will find a way to say, like, oh, now Ethereum is doing the thing that everyone asked it to, but now it's also rugging layer twos. And so there's some frustration out of the Ethereum community saying, like, there's no way to win. There's no way to win here.
There's never any way to win in crypto. Yeah.
Isn't he an ETH guy? Like, he's got a 0x at the start of his name.
Yeah, that only, so does Mert, though.
That's
fair. Yeah.
I feel like the DeFi Llama guys kind of, they fairly will talk shit about anything, which I respect.
Why do you respect
yeah, they're pretty
that?
Neutral.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, I think it's worth talking about because, you know, you mentioned the long tail of L2s and how that might actually look, right? Like, that was the, when we say this move to scale the L1, like that is kind of rugging the L2s because like, yeah, you're going to take users away from some L2s, right? You're going to be the place to go to for high value DeFi. You know, it's going to be like habitable for some applications. And we talked about that. And it's like, yeah, like some of those L2s probably shouldn't exist, right? Like that's actually going to happen. If you weren't meaningfully different from mainnet, it's like tough cookie, right? You're probably going to die off. And Ethereum will accrue more value because of that, right? Because it actually has direct users interacting on the thing, accruing fees. You know, we don't like to value things based on fees, but like you're going to need that if you're going to try to be a smart contract platform. I believe that, like even for the PSYOP component of it. Yeah, like this probably is going to lead to some L2s withering from the vine, but it's necessary. I actually did some numbers today and saw that there's several L2s, I think four right now, that are all actually at a net loss purely on on-chain profit. So like the cost it takes to post down to L1 versus how much they're generating in fees from user activity, they're negative. Tyco is all the way down to 5 million in the negative, right? So it's like... That's a crazy figure, right? And it's like some of these teams are going to have to shut down at some point if they lose even more activity to a stronger mainnet.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling on it is like if mainnet doing this means you have to shut down, you're going to have to shut down anyways, and this is just like accelerating that process, like probably your L2 is dead regardless. And so like, yeah, I guess it sucks, but it's not their fault.
Yeah, I think as soon as there became like some mania about launching layer twos, there became this like thing where like, oh, what do we do next? Let's launch a layer two. As soon as that like meta happened, this outcome was also destined to happen. Because if you're just launching a layer two because that's what is in the meta, that means you're not launching it for a real purpose. You're doing it just to like pump the token. And so as soon as that meta set in, then there was ultimately going to be like a reckoning for layer twos because we just had too many layer twos hit the market.
The thing that I haven't seen, have you guys seen this at all? Has anyone from a major L2 that is undoubtedly successful and like you feel pretty good that they're going to have a spot even with ETH L1 scaling? I haven't seen like anyone important from those types of places coming out and saying, hey, like we really don't like this, that you're competing with us. Like I haven't seen any of that. And that, like that's kind of the test to me is like the people who should feel secure, they all seem fine with it. Like, yeah, yeah, if you're the last L2 and you just can't get users, you like should shut down probably.
Alex from ZK Sync has been pounding the drum. I saw my tweet that said like, yeah, if like you were gonna die, you're gonna die anyways. And like I got a like from Jesse on that. So he kind of was signaling some of that. I would say anyone that's firmly in the like we're trying something new, novel, different camp has been in favor of it. Mm-hmm. The question is, like I know like we had talked last week that, you know, the vision for Ethereum was like, okay, you're gonna have 1,000,000,000,000 L2s. What do you still see that future if Ethereum is trying to take a more dominant position within the ecosystem and actually own some use cases? Do you still think, hey, we're going to get enough of these L2s that come out that actually will accrue value in the same way, or we expect more direct value because a portion of that, the long tail, is actually just going to live on L1?
I know I asked this question to Andrew from Conduit. And also Georgios about like, hey, how many L2s do you think that they are? There will be in the future. And their answer was, there will be an amount of layer twos that correlates to the demand for compute. And I think there is, and like the idea is you could spin up an ephemeral layer two, a layer two that, you know, spins up and then goes away in a week. If there's a momentary demand for compute for some reason, some game existed, some game popped up, something. But what's been happening like over the last 2 years during like the layer two mania where everyone was launching layer two is like they tried to front run future demand that actually ended up not being there. And so if there's going to be a million layer twos, it's going to be responsive to demand. It's going to be a reaction to demand, not trying to like supply net new block space into the market. And John, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, yeah, I don't think that like ETH L1 doing any scaling is ever going to shift whatever the long run outcome is of like how many chains are we going to need. Because I mean, today, I don't think that we actually need a lot of chains. It is just people with experimenting with different flavors of serving mostly the same kind of handful of use cases. The world where you end up with a lot of chains in the long run is where you like you actually need them for different applications. And you're spinning them up, you know, taking them down quickly. They're like very, very high scale. That's just a completely different thing than what Ethereum L1 is like actually trying to do here and is ever going to do. And so like it's never going to encroach on that market if it ever exists. It's just that the practical reality today is the long tail of chains today isn't serving these like unique high scale use cases. They're just like another EVM blockchain with like 1 second block times that does the same stuff. Like that's all the stuff that gets cannibalized. It's just that the long tail today isn't actually really justified. If you have a justifiable long tail of chains in the future, then like ETH-L1 can't compete with that. Like it never will.
Yeah. And it's like, we already have fast L1 chains that exist, and that hasn't totally made every other L1 chain that could ever exist obsolete.
I think I'd love to be a fly on the wall inside of Optimism, because I've always thought the Optimism business model as a chain, you know, building the super chain, building interop inside of the super chain, taking a 10% rake of all of the fees of every super chain is actually the business model that that people wanted Ethereum to be itself. And Optimism in the superchain model was kind of just like running interception on like what Ethereum was trying to be, but it was using, you know, more centralized coordination around the Optimism superchain in order to achieve the Ethereum vision for itself inside of its more siloed gate. And so while Optimism, you know, the Optimism mainnet has never been really elevated and prioritized by the Optimism product, they've always tried to be like the super chain, and like, you know, Base is part of the super chain, world chain is part of the super chain, and these are literally the biggest layer twos out there. But it would be interesting to see like discussions from the Optimism side of things, because to me they've built a microcosm of the larger Ethereum system, and out of the weakness of the layer one is why like there was so much demand for that, and like even Arbitrum and ZK Sync were all trying to like race for that same vision of a unified network of chains that Ethereum couldn't produce because it didn't figure out interop and it didn't have the layer one scale. John, what's your take on that?
I still don't think this is going to change any of that. The services and level of tech that they need to build there are still a different gap from what Ethereum is going to be doing here. I mean, like part of it, particularly for Optimism, is literally like it's shared governance and management of a bridge contract. I mean, you can argue that the native rollup stuff will like eventually encroach on like some of that, but I think that's just like a better product and it's years away and it is sort of different. And then a lot of the more like opinionated technical interop, I mean, if any of these chains do end up going into like some form of whether like shared sequencing, shared building, whatever, I mean, like Ethereum isn't going to be competing on that. It really is just trying to take back that, you know, hey, we should be able to service like general use cases here of like a typical good chain. And I don't view that as mostly encroaching on what they're kind of doing there.
Mm-hmm. This was actually kind of I had a debate with Alex again, ZK Sync back in the day, because like it's always the bickering on timeline is about value accrual, right? So it's like having that discussion with him is like, oh cool, we can handle the compute of the entire world. It's like, yeah, cool, but does value go back to Ethereum, right? Like that's what anyone cares about. And then he would talk about, oh, how this actually drives value to the single token ZK Sync and does stuff. So I was like, yeah, but like how does that get back to Ethereum? How does Ethereum gain in that world? Which is kind of frustrating for me as someone that like, and maybe just everyone broadly, it's like you see so much goodwill energy going into all of this stuff, and people are like, oh yeah man, we're building, we're doing the mission, we're executing, we're creating this interoperable world that can like onboard the world to this quote-unquote Ethereum stuff. But it's like, if it doesn't drive value back to ETH token, like you're just not going to have people that are excited, happy, or okay with the outcome. Like I'm sorry, like that, like, and I know like the last few weeks has been a lot of like trying to make sure there's a clear delineation between ETH the asset and ETH the technology and the culture and the ethos and stuff. I think you really got to marry those two things, and those interop stacks, which have a central token at the hub of all of those things, right? That like, that's the countervailing forces. That's like, these people have incentive to drive value to their token, which kind of guides their decisions away from driving value directly to Ethereum, the asset. And that has always been the critique of going down this roadmap, is you just insert a bunch of incentives between these teams, the man hours they're putting in, and then ETH, the asset, going up.
Yeah, it's like death by a thousand cuts, kind of small little tokens carving out $1 billion of market cap over and over and over again that could theoretically be accrual to ETH, or, you know, speculation in ETH.
Which is why I'm continuing to push that, like, if I'm joining John's camp here, it's like we just need to accept that these are all separate chains. Like I'm going to try to get rid of the L1, L2 conversation, because like whenever you just view them all as separate chains with their own incentives, with their own motivations, and like Ethereum, the team, the researchers, everyone, they can only defend as far as Ethereum, the actual chain goes, right? Like that's the end of their domain. you can only do so much to that point. And then from there, it's just like people are going to do their own thing to drive value to their own pockets, to do their own, because like on a long enough time horizon, that's just how this stuff tends to trend. So it's like,
yeah,
make sure that you're in a dominant position within your sphere. Try to provide some services and stuff if this is the long-term tail, but like don't prioritize that stuff over giving yourself the value, again, to the properties that you have, like centers of resistance, liveness, all that stuff.
Yeah, totally. And I think like even talking about why L2s became so popular and kind of that like fad phase of like, oh, we're going to launch an L2 is, you know, if it was as easy to launch a layer one as it was to launch an L2 using some of these like roll up as a service things, they probably would have been L1s. They probably wouldn't have been L2s, but it was just like the easiest way to do things. And they had like some amount of value alignment, you know, BS that they could say. And so like, I totally agree. They're just their own chain with their own incentives trying to, you know, make their company or their token valuable. And the L2 just at the point in time where they launched it was probably the path of least resistance.
You may have already heard about Infinex. Infinex has, in my opinion, the nicest cross-chain swap and bridge feature that you will find anywhere. It is called Swidge, swap and bridge, and we're going to show you what it looks like. First, we're going to log into my Infinex account with a passkey. Now, there's no seed phrases in Infinex. This is just a one-click setup with biometric passkeys. But in addition to that, my Infinex account is fully non-custodial. So bam, I just logged in. It was two clicks and I'm already into my Infinex account. So let's go make a swidge. I'm gonna go swidge my USDC that is on Base, and I'm gonna buy Barrachain, which is a completely different chain. So we're gonna swidge this. I'm gonna press that button, and then Infinex is gonna execute this order, this cross-chain order for me. And now it is done. But actually, I'm not really feeling bearish anymore. So I'm gonna go from Barra to Penguins. I'm gonna buy a Penguin on Solana. So I'm going from the Barrachain to Solana. See, no transaction signing, no gas to worry about. You just swidge across whatever chain that you want with Infinex. That was so easy. Go check out Infinex and try your first swidge today. In the wild west of DeFi, stability and innovation are everything, which is why you should check out Frax Finance, the protocol revolutionizing stablecoins, DeFi, and rollups. The core of Frax Finance is Frax USD, which is backed by BlackRock's institutional Biddle Fund. Frax designed Frax USD for best-in-class yields across DeFi, T-bills, and carry trade returns all in one. Just head to frax.com, then stake it to earn some of the best yields in DeFi. Want even more? Bridge your Frax USD over to the Fractal Layer 2 for the same yield plus Fractal points, and explore Fractal's diverse Layer 2 ecosystem with protocols like Curve, Convex, and more, all rewarding early adopters. Frax isn't just a protocol. It's a digital nation powered by the FXS token and governed by its global community. Acquire FXS through Frax.com or your go-to DEX, stake it, and help shape Frax Nation's future. Ready to join the forefront of DeFi? Visit Frax.com now to start earning with Frax USD and staked Frax USD. And for Bankless listeners, you can use frax.com/r/bankless when bridging to Fractal for exclusive Fractal perks and boosted rewards. Imagine a world where your day-to-day banking runs on a blockchain. That's exactly what Mantle is building, powered by a $4 billion treasury and poised to become the largest sustainable on-chain financial hub. As part of their 2025 expansion, Mantle is introducing three new core innovation pillars that bridge traditional finance with decentralized technology. First is their enhanced index fund, aiming for $1 billion in AUM by Q1. It provides optimized exposure to Bitcoin, ETH, Solana, and USD, complete with built-in yield opportunities. Next, Mantle Banking promises to revolutionize global value transfer through seamless blockchain-powered banking services, bridging crypto into your daily life. Finally, Mantle X blends AI with DeFi to deliver an intelligent, user-friendly experience for everyone. And the best part is that this is all in addition to their already launched products like Mantle Network, METH, and FBTC. Ready to step into the future of finance? Follow Mantle on X at Mantle_official and join the on-chain revolution today. When it comes to the conversation of ETH value accrual, I think anyone can kind of, it's a little bit of a Rorschach test. And I think we actually have three interesting different perspectives here on the table today. Like John, I'll put in the technical rationalism camp. Andy, I'll put in the trader camp, where if he's having fun and making money on a particular chain, he's bullish on that particular chain. Doesn't really stay on the left curve side of that bell curve. You don't have to think about it too hard. If having fun, then bullish on the layer one. Brett, I don't know exactly where Brett falls on this. Maybe somewhere a little bit closer to John. But then there's also the camp that we've seen from Sam Kasmanian and also Ryan Sean Adams, of people just saying, hey, just talk about the asset in a reserve asset global reserve asset context and like meme that into existence. And I'm seeing a little bit of those, like the blind man feeling the elephant, like everyone's kind of seeing this one shape. And now, you know, depending on what your bias is, what your interpretation is, you have a different explanation as to like why ETH is the way that it is and not the way that it's not. Brad, what do you think about this?
I'm accepting. So I listened to Sam's podcast on Head of the Day. It's great. I agree that if you aim to achieve higher valuations, like in the realm of a Bitcoin or beyond, even where Ethereum is today, you have to have people that buy into this like sovereign money, like ownership, digital oil. Like you have to have that belief. But I do not think the path to get there is just to be like, Bitcoin's a special snowflake. You like, they've done it. They have the hard cap. They have this story that they can tell. A smart contract platform cannot do that. I think you need fees to generate like the basal level of like bullishness for a chain. And then if you maintain the properties or display properties that are even more powerful than that, again, censorship resistance, maximal decentralization, all this stuff, you allow a subset of the community to dream higher and tell the story of, oh, you guys are looking at fees, but look at all this other stuff we can do, right? Like all nation states are willing to participate on this chain because we've shown that we've defended against Tornado Cash, right? Like we've shown that it's incredibly neutral for all of time and it can stand up against other nation states, right? It's all this stuff. So you need the basal level of activity and excitement and fees generated to like get like just like a basal level of valuation for the thing. And then you let others dream bigger by displaying the moneyness properties, which is a byproduct of being useful. I don't think it is something you can just like straight up say, oh, we're money, don't worry about it. And then like everyone's just going to come to, because you have rational people step in and go, what are you talking about? Like you guys were making a bunch of fees. You're not making a bunch of fees. And then like you get in the argument about that stuff. So I think, yeah, that's my general position. You need a blend of the two. I think path dependency is what matters.
So you're saying like we need a strong layer one with strong layer one fundamental value accrual, something that would appease the John Charbonneaus of the world. And then we can take that to the Ryan Sean Adams of the world and say, hey, here's the foundation that you have to leverage to turn this into what Ryan is calling like the blue money cult.
Basically, yeah. Because John always pointed out, you can't do the DCF on these things and come to a rational valuation. You just can't, right? Like, but you need that to a degree for people like him to build some investor confidence so people can actually do the DCF stuff, right? There's yield coming. There's like all this stuff I can do. And like, you guys aren't seeing the bigger picture because it's yes, this much on DCF, but also, did you know these properties? Do you see what's coming down the pipe with Russia wants to do an exchange with China and they can only do it on Ethereum layer one because it's the only thing that's credibly neutral. They're going to buy this thing because they have to do it here. So like, let these people tell the story on top of the actual DCF stuff. I think you need the blend. Yeah.
So I think you actually need to focus less on the economics if you want ETH to have a shot at winning as the sovereign money kind of thing. So I agreed with a lot of what Sam had talked about in there of that kind of the focus on stuff like the burn over the past few years and the ultrasound money thing was the wrong focus. I mean, like I have very openly said, like, I think that was the wrong focus. That was for a mix of reasons. I think that the burn is less important than, you know, just capturing the value in the first place. But then also, like, so much of the argument of why ETH is better money than Bitcoin that most Ethereum people try to harp on is all economics based. And I think that fundamentally you cannot win that argument. I do not think that, and like I saw this in like Ryan's latest post too of like digital gold plus yield. Like I think you can say these things if you want. I don't think that anything economic based can ever be the core pitch of like why ETH is better money than Bitcoin. I think that is a game that you will just always lose. If you're going to have any shot at ETH, like actually being able to flip Bitcoin or any other asset that like is actually trying to take this shot at non-sovereign money, I think you need to win it in just a totally differentiated way. And what that very simply looks like to me is that you just are the winning tech platform. Like everything is built on Ethereum. And naturally, like you are the most, like you are the obvious, just like censorship resistant, programmable asset at the center of that ecosystem. And then you hope that that puts you in a good position, because I don't think that like ETH will ever be able to stand in an argument against Bitcoin and say like, you know, pitch BlackRock, like, hey, because of these qualities, let's burn whatever we have economics, like this is better than Bitcoin. They don't care. Like they just want the predictability. This is digital gold. Like that's fine. That wins this bucket. The only shot that I think that you have at winning is being really, really differentiated of like, this is the usable programmable money and like everything is built on us. And then the other half of it is I think that it is still entirely Bitcoin's game to lose. If Bitcoin just manages to figure out roll-up scaling and like manages to deal with just like the quantum risk in a few years, as in like some manageable way and like figures out the security budget. I honestly don't think there's anything that any chain can do to compete with Bitcoin. I think that like what you need to do if you're just going to best position yourself is like, when does the tech platform get everything built on you? Everyone is using your asset. Like you're kind of right in the middle of that. And then you kind of honestly just like hope that Bitcoin just like kind of drops the ball and then you're naturally the best positioned after that. I think that also sets you up in the best kind of like fallback scenario anyway. I think that's naturally what will maximize your cash flows anyway. So I think it ends up looking very similar. Like what do you actually prioritize to do this is like, I think that it is a lot of like L1 scaling stuff that's like just going to produce additional cash flows. It's just like, what is the pitch and the prioritization that I think is going to matter more in the long run to like give you a shot at winning? I think it's less of like Ryan's article about like, we need to talk about ETH more. Because that was the main thing I disagreed with him in there is like he said in there like ETH isn't lagging because of tech, it's because the conviction is like all like sharded and mixed up. That I disagree with. I think it has lagged because the ecosystem itself has like fallen behind a bit on usage versus others, and so the probability of, you know, how big is this Ethereum thing going to be, like, has naturally shrunk. If I was like super convinced that Ethereum was actually going to win, as you know, this is going to be the big smart contract platform, like all the rollups are going to be built on here, like I think ETH will go up because your probability of that happening, I think, would have to go up pretty meaningfully.
Yeah,
I think we're saying the same thing. Mine was not to like focus on the messaging being the technical stuff. I think you build for the tech platform, talk about the moneyness, right? I think that's like, that's what I have that frame in my head. Like, you have to build for the usefulness, which brings the fees, which generates that stuff. But then you have to talk about why you're a better thing than Bitcoin, even though like, yeah, that's a hard battle to fight. But
I think even in the what you talk about, you talk less about the economics than people do today. I think you even talk about that less too. I think you talk about how this is the best tech platform, and then we are the natural, like we are the programmable asset at the core of the winning tech platform. Like I think that is higher in the messaging than the economics are better. Like even when you're pitching BlackRock and why ETH is better money, I think the first bullet point is like, we win as the tech platform. Like ETH is the decentralized asset at the middle of that. Like if ETH wins, fundamentally, the only way you can use Bitcoin in this on-chain economy is like you're using CBBTC, some bridged version, whatever, that's like super trusted. I think it's much easier to make that argument than the economics one, because I just don't think anyone's going to care. I don't think you're like just ever going to win that battle to anyone. It's always just going to be strictly worse. It's just like it's a different, smaller thing. So like even in the investment pitch, I think it needs to be like, we're the winning tech platform. And that's like that's why we're the best money, is because like this is the platform that everything is built on top of. This is the only asset that can be the most decentralized, most secure asset in this economy if this is the winning platform and the winning rails.
So I think maybe, John, and you might agree, and Brad too, that like maybe the price, the valuation that has deflated out of ETH over the last 2 to 3 years has run hand in hand with the decreasing Ethereum dominance as a smart contract platform. And so maybe the notion of ETH as money just disappears when Ethereum dominance as a smart contract platform goes from like 90%, just even down to like 60%. Whereas in 90%, you are the dominant smart contract platform. There is no second best. But at 60%, there actually is a second best. And maybe it's not really anything about Solana specifically, but the fact that there is a valid contender in a saturated market. And then after Solana, well, then why can't there be a third and fourth and fifth? And all of a sudden, the notion of a smart contract platform gets very commoditized. And so the difference between 60% dominant and 90% dominant is the difference in monetary premium versus being just a tech play with a DCF model. Andy, what's up?
Yeah, well, I just think like, I think that's that part of it to me is what's most interesting. Because like, to be honest, I've never cared about the whole like ETH is money conversation. As someone who's been building on ETH for a very long time, I've always thought ETH was interesting and got into it because of the tech. And like, you know, it has, as someone who now makes the majority of my living being a degen on chain, like I have very heavily moved my transactions off of Ethereum mainnet and like even off of L2s for the most part. Like the majority of my transactions for the last couple of years have been on Solana. And like, if you had told me that 3 years ago, I would have said, that's insane. Like, there's just no way that could ever possibly happen. And so kind of like you were saying, David, like the moment there is a second best and you see that Ethereum is continually not the fastest horse when it comes to upgrading the tech and like maintaining lead and just like being cutthroat and competitive, then it's like, okay, we can extrapolate this out. And there's a lot of money to be made here for no one to come and like really, really come for the king and try to be better. And then it just becomes like very, very reasonable to tell yourself a story of how it continues to fall off more and more.
What was the first thing that pulled you over? Was it activity?
Yeah. I guess this was like, I guess like pretty post FTX crash, like relatively close FTX crash. I just like bought a bunch of, I sold almost all of my Ethereum for Solana. And then because of that, like as Pump Fun and memes all moved over there, there just wasn't really anything happening on ETH. Like NFTs had died off for the most part at this point. And they're just like, what, I'm going to sit in Aave and do nothing. So like, yeah, sure. Some of my stuff does that, but not nearly as much as it used to.
Gotcha. So you saw the Black Swan opportunity, figured that was probably a good buy, and then just came up with the activity after that.
Yeah. It's just like, that was where things continued to happen. That's where the majority of opportunities have been over the last couple of years.
Yeah. This just kind of goes back to this idea that there's a pretty large cohort of people who are just chain neutral, and they are just stoked about whatever layer one asset is giving them the opportunities to have fun casino games and potentially make money as well. And like, if that's Solana, if that's Ethereum, it doesn't really matter. But if the chain is fun, then there's some sort of like premium, I won't call it a monetary premium, but some sort of valuation premium that is associated with that layer one chain.
I don't know. I think that's moneyness.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that like that actually is the money part. Like ETH is not money to me because I could theoretically buy a coffee with it. Like I don't really care about that, but I use it to, you know, for a long time, every day I was sending hundreds of transactions on Ethereum where it was literally the money that I was paying to do things with. And like that has just died off. And so then Solana has for the most part replaced it, or like USDC has replaced it in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, that's always been my argument for these things, right? Or what L2s in the current paradigm, how they add value to Ethereum, right? Like you buy ETH on Base because you want to ape 10K into a virtuals protocol, right? Like that's that medium of exchange demand that comes from that. Something. It's the same thing with Solana, right? You go over to Solana and you're not holding on to 100 Solana because transactions are expensive because it's pretty cheap, right? Fast and cheap. You buy 20 grand worth of Solana because you want to ape it into a shitter, right? Like that's all buy pressure, right? Or if I don't even want to do the shitter, I can buy, you know, the same amount thinking that Andy's going to go over there and do that stuff because Andy, like, because I see it as a necessary asset to do the next cool thing, right? So you know buy pressure is going to come in as a byproduct of that. So like they didn't build for moneyness in that same way. They didn't build to be the medium of exchange, all this shit. They built for a useful tech platform for a Pump Fund. And because Pump Fund built there, now people need it as a medium of exchange. It's the thing next to the hot asset, right? The hot state. And therefore you get some asset appreciation out of that, and then bullish narratives come out of it and everything else.
So if the meta is like, all right, we're all trading meme coins right now, and somebody takes $100,000, deposits it into Coinbase because they want to buy a meme coin on Solana, a Pump Fund shitter. They take that $100,000, they buy Sol. That turns into a $100,000 of buy pressure on Sol. Then they take that Sol over to Pump Fund and they dump $100,000 into a meme coin. They sell Sol and they dump $100,000 of Sol for this meme coin shitter. But that buy pressure still showed up on Coinbase. And I don't think selling it into a meme coin actually takes away from Solana USD liquidity and Solana USD demand, right? I don't think that's true.
Yeah, well, because like, you know, I don't know what the numbers are, but there is like a lot of Solana locked up in dead radium pools of Pump Fund coins that have been totally abandoned. And so it's like the market cap of a completely abandoned coin on Pump Fund is still like mid $5,000s, $5,000 or $6,000. And so that's a couple $1,000s of Solana that's locked up literally forever and is never coming back out. And that probably has been more burn than like the ETH burn over the years, if we did the math.
It actually made it deflationary for a little bit, which is impressive given Solana's inflation is actually higher than Ethereum.
Yeah. And like we all know this pattern, right? Ether was like this reserve currency for the ICO mania in 2017. It was the money that everyone used in DeFi for DeFi farms in 2020. And then it was the NFT money in 2021. And so, there's just kind of there's this speculative fervor, and there is the denominator asset for that and whatever that is. And it's interesting that like right now, I don't know what the current meta is. Maybe Andy, you can kind of tell me what the traders are doing these days, what the kiddos are doing. But like, I don't know what the common denominator asset is, because meme coins are still alive, but they're not like where they were. Right now, the virtuals ecosystem is up bigly. That's back on Base. But that's actually with the virtuals unit of account, interestingly. But there is no kind of hot ball of money going around right now. So I don't really know where what happens next in that whole in the trader arc.
Yeah, I mean, like Pump Fund is still doing pretty serious numbers as far as revenue and volume goes. Not as much as, you know, peak mania, but I don't have it in front of me, but it's still a lot. I would say that's probably still the main kind of thing, but it does sort of feel like people, you know, in all my group chats and stuff are just like waiting for the next interesting thing, and kind of just like biding their time trading meme coins. And if one goes to even like, you know, $5 or $10 million, they're like, wow, this was incredible. Whereas previously that's like table stakes. So that part of it definitely has seemingly changed. But yeah, the virtual stuff that launched on Base is cool. It's funny that they've gone back and forth, like snip, snap, snip, snap. But they're trying to like actually address some of the like sniping problems on, you know, these like fair launch tokens. And so they moved to a pre-sale model. It's been interesting to see all these different teams try to figure out ways to like launch a token that doesn't just get destroyed by like snipers and scammers.
I do think that the snipers is the number one problem about the sustainability of meme coins and token generation events. Like, it seems to be like the arc of meme coins ended when these snipers just started winning too hard, because that was how the Libra debacle fell off. And so there's this like race to solve the sniper problem to like unlock the next like progression of meme coins.
I'm still surprised that the value prop, like for all the faults that the typical L2 constructions have, right, with the sequencer building on the blocks, like you do have the benefits of a private mempool, right? So like you don't have to worry about people sandwich attacking you, right? Everyone is aware of it at the same time. It's hard to do same block buying that you're seeing with a lot of these launches on Solana, where it's like, I think I heard Blockworks talk about the numbers, and it was something like 80% of all pump fund launches have an initial buy in the exact same block in which the thing is launched. And then like 50% of those end in profit, sold 5 minutes later. So like the grinder is just ridiculous over there right now. But like, that's possible because, like, you know, that stuff's open, like it's been industrialized, right? Because it's been around for a while. The value prop of doing something on an L2 right now is that, you know, that can't happen to the same degree because it's not all fully exposed block building.
Yeah, I'm surprised by that as well. It's something that I kind of at different points in time thought that we would get with Base, and we got it to certain extents. But I really, like, as silly as it sounds, I kind of just feel like everyone who has a hot ball of DGEN money moved over to Solana, and like Phantom Wallet kind of won that world and Pump Fund won already. And it's just so hard to unseat them. Like, you really have to have some serious step level improvement. And I think a lot of these traders don't even know that that would be a step level improvement for them, that like not be like they're sandwiching and stuff. They probably just don't even really know it exists, and or they're using Jito and they don't care. But I'm a little bit surprised we haven't seen more activity on L2s for that same reason.
Meme coins itself as a category has been so much more sticky than any other mania that's come before it. You know, NFTs came and went, and, you know, ICOs came and went, and like DeFi Summer came and went, but meme coins came and they are still here. And it doesn't really seem like they are going away like anytime soon. And I think every ecosystem is trying to find its like pump fund, but nothing's really taking away anything from Pump Fund itself.
For this virtuals thing, so like I haven't looked at it closely, if you guys have. The idea of this like new launch thing that they're doing is it's supposed to be like you do a pre-sale basically of the token at like some fixed price, right?
Yeah.
That's the basic idea of virtual launch. What is the reason for doing that as opposed to the other main idea that I've heard before that I don't think I've seen before with meme coins is like just running a duck auction or something before you launch it. And so you get like an actual market. Mm-hmm. Like floating, the market sets the price as opposed to like some arbitrary fixed price here. I didn't really understand the mechanic of that as opposed to
It's funny. I remember talking to David about this at a party once while we were drinking wine. But I think really the issue, because like I agree theoretically that like a Dutch auction makes a ton of sense. I think
technically
like,
better.
Yeah. Like I think what's the name of the, is it
Doppler? From Lawson Adams. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like they're doing stuff like kind of in that vein. But the issue is that it doesn't fill like, or scratch the itch of like, I want to turn one Solana into 10,000 Solana. And like, that is so much more the driving force than like, I need the absolute fair market entry price at the start of this
ticket
thing. Yeah. And so I think it's just like, if you could find a way, and like I'm honestly shocked that we haven't seen meme coins on like World Chain become popular. Some way to like truly Sybil resistance meme coin launch where like you could have an actually fair, you know, $10 per human meme coin launch or something. Like, I think it could potentially work. But it's just like, if you don't have that lottery ticket style mm-hmm. potential, it's just not as compelling for a lot of people.
What I'm hearing is it's a mid-curve approach to meme coins. Yeah. Is like, everyone's just like, bro, just give me the lottery ticket. I want maximum extraction, but also maximum upside. And then like, oh, but it's not fair. You don't realize you're getting taken advantage of, sir. They're like, what are you talking about? Give me my lottery ticket.
Yeah. I was like, I still want to do that 10-leg parlay NFL Sunday.
Yes.
I know it's not the right move, but I still want to do it. But I think, David, quickly on what you were talking about of meme coins being sticky, I was talking about this with a couple of friends the other day, and my response was like, casinos have had the same casino games for a very long time. And like, I kind of feel like we've just gotten to a bit of what the like logical conclusion of like on-chain casino looks like. And I think it will continue to evolve and change for sure. But like, People obviously like to risk money and gamble on the blockchain, and I don't see that stopping. And until there is a more efficient way than meme coins to do it for this like true PvP like system, right. I don't think it'll be replaced. And like the flavor of what it is might change, whether it's, you know, AI or animals or whatever, right. but it's still kind of the same thing.
Yeah, it's still on-chain liquidity PvPing, which is what I think everyone is getting pulled into. Like when you and I were talking, Andy, I was like going down the Flaunch rabbit hole. And I think talking about like, oh yeah, there's like, what about like a 30-minute window where if you're interested, you can come and you can buy the meme coin. It's just 30 minutes long. And then the people who get in inside of this 30-minute window, they're the early ones and everyone else is like, it's only 30 minutes. But like, I think I still underestimated this, like the power of this like human centipede of virality, where if you are number one, you are twice as early as number two. And if you are number two, you are twice as early as number four. And so the incentive to just like send some like pump fun shitter link to your friend and being like, hey, buy this. And then your friend like repeats that down the line across Telegram. That's like, I think that's how like a railgun works. That railgun method of just like a viral meme coin is just so incredibly powerful that optimizing for like 20% better execution just does not hold a candle to that, whatever phenomenon that is.
The problem I still have with all this though is how we're saying like if this is reaching kind of the logical conclusion of like basically on-chain casino, is that, and I've heard people argue this before, but of like, this is just strictly worse than a casino. Because the good thing about a casino is like they have actually optimized basically all of the odds to extract just enough such that you don't like screw all of the customers over so that they all leave, they keep coming back. Versus that's the problem with these meme coins, like at least as currently constructed, if we don't move to any kind of like auction or whatever kind of different format, is everyone who's individually launching a single token is just like incentivized to max extract. And so the market equilibrium ends up being you just extract like way more than the users are actually willing to take and then like keep playing over time. Like it just ends up looking like that roller coaster meme of like the circle just keeps getting like a little bit smaller every time. And it feels like we're just going forward with that. Where I don't think meme coins are obviously going away. They're never going to. I mean, the big ones are going to last forever. And I don't even think that the current iteration is going to go away of this like current pump fund meta. But I can't see that like as currently constructed that it would keep growing or even sustain what it's at. Like it feels like it has to just start like churning people out at like the kind of the current economics of
it. Well, I think like the one thing though with that, because I agree with you, but it's worse than a casino odds wise, but it's better than a casino marketing, because no one knows the odds. And the average idiot online sees some 19-year-old post a picture of his Ferrari and goes, I could do that. No one thinks that going to sit down at the blackjack table, but they think that when they put 10 Solana in their Phantom wallet. And so that's the major difference right now. And so like, I think that's why it's been so cyclical, where there are these really long periods of lulls and periods of like total mania, because there is a ton of money that is leaving the system every single time. And you just like need time to refresh after that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, let's not act like it's any different than just like crypto broadly, right? Like these people doing this stuff don't even know the difference between the value accrual methods and valuations of any of these things, like the layer one blockchains, layer two blockchains, DeFi protocols, meme coins, whatever, right? That's a narrative that most of the stuff is meme coins. So for them, it's the same thing. You see the upside from everyone else and then you get hurt and then you go, I'm ready to be hurt again after some period of time. And then you go back in.
The thing that's surprising to me is My guess is that more people than you'd expect understand how bad the odds are, just because of really high profile blowups at this point of like the Trump coin chart is terrible. Like this, that's just not a good chart. Like most people who have bought that thing are down. And then you look at like the Malay chart, burned a ton of people, just like straight nuke. Like those are the examples that most people have seen. I have been surprised at the level of meme coin volume that has continued after that of like, PumpFund is still just ripping. Like they're just still making a ton of money every day. People are still using it a lot. I have been surprised that it didn't make more of a dent having these really high profile examples where everyone sees that like, yeah, you're probably going to lose money on this. Like it's not going to be a great outcome. I've been surprised at how sticky it has been even with that happening.
I think it's just like a tale as old as time with gambling in general. I think it's like still just people who are doing this and, you know, think they have a chance, if they don't actually have an edge, are like pretty irrational, whether they're sports betting or at the blackjack table or playing meme coins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that post-Trump, post-Libra, there was a cleansing of the market where people without edge just either did get burned or identify that they don't have edge and they left. And the people who are left playing the meme coin game are sophisticated. They know the game. They are aware of the odds. They like are doing it for fun. They're doing it with their funny money. And so the market that is left of doing that is the people who are doing it are not casuals. They are people who are think about this day in, day out, and they are the ones who are responsible for like this, you know, sustained high volumes here.
I describe it as the like the Malay Libra situation was the lights coming on at the club at 3 a.m. Like mm-hmm. everyone's like, what is going on? Like, I am disgusted with myself. Like, this is not what I want to be doing. I need to go home and shower. Right. So, like, the average person left, and then like, you know, the people that are all, like doing that every other night are still there playing the game.
Chronic
like,
partiers.
Chronic partiers are still doing that stuff. They're doing a line in the bathroom. Like, they're having a great time.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, I saw some comments on the timeline of just people saying that it was like trench warfare between different cults of meme coiners over the last few weeks, but it was starting to heal a little bit. So it was like everyone had formed these little cabals of trying to launch these coins and make these games, whatever. There's actually a lot of dashboards for tracking wallets of like key KOLs and shit. So like a lot of that was going on pretty heavily for the last month or so. And then now it's starting like, okay, momentum starting to pick back up and it's starting to be a little more PVE.
Yeah. I do wonder like once if this does really like actually get frothy again, there's more energy going back into this. If the equilibrium finds a more sustainable place where more people aren't just getting raked over and over and over again, it's actually a little bit more sustainable and it's, you know, the more casual people can actually play for a longer time without actually getting their shit handed to them. I would hope so, obviously, but I don't really know if there's any sort of reasons why the rake just wouldn't get more rakey over time.
Well, I mean, the one nice thing is like generally in the history of crypto things, like fees have somewhat trended towards zero over time. And like, you know, there was a period of time where it seemed insane that like royalties would ever go away or these different things. And like, sure, there's still going to be extraction events and stuff. But these markets are like, you know, long enough time horizon, they can be pretty efficient. And like, I have to think that it will happen eventually. People will only, you know, lose money so much, but they still want to fuel their gambling addiction, that they'll try to get better or they'll move to competitors who are trying to take less. But I doubt it'll be super soon.
Uniswap is your gateway to a more efficient DeFi experience. With Uniswap, swapping and bridging across 13 chains is simple, fast, and cost-effective, helping you move value wherever, whenever. Thanks to deep liquidity on the Uniswap protocol, you'll enjoy minimal price impact on every trade. And now Uniswap V4 takes it even further. Swappers benefit from gas savings on multi-hop swaps and ETH trading pairs, while liquidity providers can create new pools at 99% lower costs. The best part, you don't have to do anything extra. Each trade is automatically routed through Uniswap X, V2, V3, and V4, so you get the most efficient swap without even thinking about it. Whether you're swapping, sending, on-ramping, off-ramping, or bridging, Uniswap's web app and wallet gives you the tools to unlock DeFi's full potential on Ethereum, Base, Arbitrum, Unichain, and more. Use Uniswap's web app and wallet for a more efficient way to use DeFi. Imagine verifying yourself without handing over personal data. No hacked databases, no unnecessary personal exposure for airdrops, and no AI bots ruining community governance. Meet Self, the on-chain identity verification protocol built for privacy and control. Self Protocol uses zero-knowledge proofs to confirm your identity safely. Users prove key details like age or citizenship without revealing sensitive personal information. Self never stores your data. It only generates cryptographic proofs. Here's how it works in three steps. First, register and verify. Use the Self app to scan your biometric passport's RFID chip. Self verifies authenticity with zero-knowledge proofs. Each passport creates one unique identity. Second, you can share proofs privately. Third-party apps request identity proofs, like confirming you're over 18. You can also link proofs securely to public wallets for airdrops or governance participation. And then last, secure verification. Apps validate your proofs instantly on-chain, like on Celo, or off-chain. Audited by ZK Security, the Self app is live on iOS and Play Store. Visit self.xyz and follow Self Protocol on X.
Redirecting a little bit. And if you played in the Hyperliquid ecosystem at all?
A little bit. Not a ton recently, but yeah.
It's something I was told myself I was going to do it this weekend. Didn't actually do it, but I'm starting to like deploy my strategy because I want exposure to hype because of the fees it's generating. It's like this enshrined application setup that seems to be finding a little bit of PMF, right? Like they're routinely at the top of chain fees, but it's a little unfair again because they have an enshrined application, which is their perps platform, but they have the EVM side, which opened up, which is this general programmable side, like sidecar that has some, I believe they're opcodes or called builder codes that allow you to like actually inherit or take some information from the perps platform and bring it into the EVM side, which is really slow. It's programmable, but like it has some appeal there. And there's like a little bit of a scene popping up. And I just think it'll probably continue to grow a little bit. And I want to make sure I have some exposure, but I don't know if that'll be straight hype or if I want to actually like go a little bit deeper.
Yeah. I was actually tweeting with someone about that literally today. Funny enough, but I think the challenge with the EVM stuff is like, I mean, I think there's a couple issues, but like one is just that people who own hype value hype so much as an asset that like they don't want to sell it. They don't want to use it as money. They want to hold it because they value
like
it so
Ordinals
much.
Like the Ordinals ecosystem?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, why am I going to sell my hype for some random shitcoin on, you know, the launch pad that exists or AI agent or whatever? And so I think that's like a big part of it. And also, like you said, the experience on the hype PerpSex and the experience on like the hype EVM are just not the same. And I think that you use the two and you're like, I don't really want to use this EVM, that there's like not that much to do. And so I think you kind of just need like one or two catalysts to really get the ball moving and get things to change. And probably odds are at some point that will happen and there will be a period of time where there's a lot of money to be made on the hype EVM. But yeah, right now it's been weird. I'm a little bit surprised at how little there has been, because I was like actually pretty bearish about the EVM launch for a lot of these reasons. I just thought people really like hype and don't want to use it for that. But I'll be curious to see how it evolves.
Yeah, what is the integration, the like synergy between the hype EVM and the actual perps platform? Like why is it just the same currency, or like what's the deal?
Like Brett said, they have some codes that you can use, like kind of enshrined opcodes to mm-hmm. access data from the mm-hmm. Exchange. And also, I believe eventually the idea is that you can also, you know, like buy and sell on the exchange through the EVM. I don't think that's live right now. But so theoretically, if there were applications that needed oracles or wanted to have like, you know, really deep liquidity for trading different things, you could like build that in the EVM and be able to access data from the exchange at the same time. That's kind of, I think, a lot of what the core value prop is. They have some other stuff that they've changed as well. They have like a dual block architecture, which is interesting, where they have like smaller blocks that are cheaper and faster and bigger blocks that are more expensive. So like you use the big blocks to deploy smart contracts for the most part and like do really complex batching or whatever, and you use the smaller blocks for regular transactions. But I think they're a little bit too small still. They're like 2 million gas. It's kind of easy to fill them up.
Interesting. Yeah.
But
yeah. Okay. Yeah. The notion of an enshrined application actually does make sense. It has like all of this very rich data and trading volume and liquidity there.
Yeah.
And
so it's like, what if Binance had a EVM
right.
around it where you could build a bunch of other right. cool stuff on top of Binance?
Right. Yeah. What if the Binance exchange and BNB were like more intimately connected with each other? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to hear John talk a little bit about like the, He was teasing a high capacity or high performance chain little R research paper, but he may never release it. So I'm going to try and see if I can tease some of it out of it right
now.
Did you cover Hyperliquid in that?
I wrote like 90% of it, and then I just haven't finished the last 10% of it. It's been sitting there for like a good month or two at this point. I need to actually finish it. I did a bit. I think the pitch of it definitely makes sense of, like, David, to your question of why the integration. I mean, a lot of it, I think, is honestly similar to Solana's thesis, just like starting from a different point of it's just beneficial to have all these things in the same place. I mean, the simple literal example is, all right, if this is just like the best, deepest liquid exchange that has all the users on it, where would you want to launch your token in your application? You know, I'm going to launch my app, obviously, right there. And then, like, you know, my token will just get listed there right away. Like, this is where all the users are. I have a tough time with it, though, seeing them build this out in practice, because, yeah, I mean, part of it is like, you could just like literally look at the numbers of this, obviously. At least as of right now, we'll see where they take it. The Hyper EVM is like not actually performant at all. It's like very on the low end of performance.
Looked it up. It's like 1/30th of base to give you like relative performance. So like if that's their throughput relative to their hyper core side, which is the perps thing, it's just like Andy was saying, like you have this mental model of like Hyperliquid fast, go, awesome, cool, whatever thing. And then you get over and you're like, what the fuck's going on? Like it's, I mean, quicksand, and I don't like it. And like, I just think that's not a great move.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a really tough area to play in, to just go build another EVM chain. And then one, to make it good, and then to have a meaningful differentiation then on top of that to get users to come use you. It's just hard to start a general purpose chain right now as an EVM. I mean, like even for guys like Mega ETH and Monad, who are great and been working at this longer, like Monad's been working on like literally this problem for years. I it seems difficult to me that like a team is just going to show up and say like, oh yeah, we're going to have this super optimized EVM and just slap it on top of this other thing and it's going to work perfectly. It's obviously like not how it's going to work. And then building up a whole general purpose ecosystem, it's just going to be really tough, particularly when you've taken away the obvious two applications that would be the thing, you know, the flagship thing that like most applications would build is its perp exchange and spot exchange. Like that's already gone. So go build the other like stuff that people already care about a little bit less. And then, hey, by the way, this actually isn't optimized. It's difficult. So like, yeah, my general bias has been the same for the past few months. It's still super bullish on them as building a great perps exchange, a really good exchange for people to use. But it's going to be super tough to like really, really drive adoption on having a meaningfully differentiated EVM right now, sticking that on there.
Yeah, I agree. I think the one thing that they have that a lot of other EVMs don't have, and I've seen this mentioned a few times, is that they just have a massive war chest of hype that they can airdrop to people. And so, you know, as we saw with UniChain over the last couple of weeks, like incentives work. And it will get people to move funds. And so that's kind of, to me, the one unknown is, I know they just had on testnet the other day, a new like points page show up on their UI. And so I could see them starting to roll out a much more aggressive incentive mechanism for using the Hyper EVM. And that could be a pretty big ball mover.
Guys, this has been, I've loved this. I think this is great. There's one last conversation that I think we should touch on before we wrap this one up. This one actually spawned on TikTok, apparently. I don't know how or why, but there, going around the internet, there is a conversation around 100 men versus one gorilla. And I think it's worth having a conversation here. I think it's nice to see how everyone thinks about this question. Maybe Brett, actually, I think you were the one that suggested this. So maybe you can kind of like lay the foundation about this debate.
Yeah. All right. So first, we got a set of parameters so everyone is aware of the conditions, right? So we're going to say neutral playing field. This is in an arena. Everyone is told to go in and fight the other thing, the 100 men versus the gorilla. Same thing with the gorilla. Assume we can communicate with it. It says, if you don't win, you're dead, right? So like there's some motivation there. For me, I think it's pretty clear. I do this on mass, right? So like if you do like the average weight of an American male, I think it was like 190 pounds. That's like 20,000 pounds roughly, and a average silverback gorilla is like 400 pounds. She got like 19,500 pounds mass difference there. So I just think logically you have to go with the humans, because the gorilla still has soft bits. It's made for burst strength and energy, right? It's not an endurance athlete like humans. there you go. A little disproportionate. Like that's what I think people like Jesus. People don't understand the size of a gorilla. It's not King Kong. It's like 400 pounds. So it's like, you know, a couple of humans. And I just think, yeah, you got to go with the gorilla, or you got to go with the humans in that instance.
I think the context of saying you will die if you do not win, I think, is important, because when I was first simulating this in my head, I didn't really have that prerequisite in the debate, because I think, like, I was thinking about this. Okay, if I am one of these 100 people and I have to go up against this silverback gorilla, which, 300 to 430 pounds. Okay, so you're right about that. That thing is fucking scary, bro. And there's no way that I'm going first. And I think most dudes like me are also not planning
it's
on
a
going
standoff,
first.
Standoff, yeah.
Yeah, and so who the hell is going to go first? And if everyone is scared of going first, that silverback gorilla can just pick us off one by one. That was kind of like my hesitancy about picking humans here.
Yeah, as long as you don't do the gladiator thing where like he walks out and just like fights like 9 other gladiators one by one and just works through it, then like, yeah gorilla's going to win every time. But like 100 people, no way.
It really depends on how coordinated the humans are.
Yeah, I guess are the humans allowed to plan before the fight starts? I'm not sure that really matters.
You have 5 minutes as a group. 100
people. I think that'd be enough time. I think that's the other aspect of it. It's just like humans are smarter than gorillas, and I think that with enough planning, you could figure it out. And the other thing that I was thinking about is like, could 10 humans beat Andre the Giant in a fight? How much did he weigh? Is a gorilla 10 times harder than Andre the Giant? Like, I don't know. I agree with Brett. I think that it's like definitely the humans. Like, do you think that you could beat 100 rats in a fight? Like, probably not.
100 rats? Yes. Different? I think I could beat 100 rats.
5,000 rats? Now it's getting weird.
Yeah.
If so you think if 100 rats came at you right now, you're standing there and 100 rats swarm you, you think you would win in a fight?
Are they New York rats?
Yeah.
Right, in New York,
they just ate some Joe's pizza and they're ready to go.
I'm just thinking that, like, if it's rats, if it's 100 rats, I can run quickly, and all I need to do is, while I am running, step on one rat at a time for a while. And if I can get them down to 50, then I'm golden.
All right, fair enough. But yeah, no, I just think it's definitely humans.
John,
so I waited to go last because I cheated and I went back and forth with ChatGPT asking what would happen here and went through different scenarios. So four attributes that matter most if the humans are going to win or not. One, willingness to die. If you have a bunch of people who are suicidal, like, odds skyrocket.
Yes.
Two is coordination and strategy. Like, if you have a plan going in, so the 5 minutes is big. And then size and skill of the fighters. So if you take 100 average men with no plan and a normal will to live, gorilla wins easily, because the reason why is panic. Most humans flee or hesitate when seeing friends being ripped apart.
I am
fear
fleeing.
Fear collapses.
I am
chance.
Running.
Gorilla wins within minutes. But if you take about 100 NFL linemen who are coordinated and willing to die, there's a greater than 95% chance that they win. And they will neutralize it fast in under 45 seconds with probably only 10 to 20 casualties.
And
the coordinated plan, and this is part of why I don't even think it works if you have people coordinate before, is because you know who's going to die. Like, the people who go in the first wave, like, they're all dead.
They're
the
all
first,
dead.
Like, two waves of people, they're all dead. But that is the optimal strategy, is you send them in coordinated waves. You take out the lower body first, and then you have, like, dedicated teams for each of the body parts. Like, you have a vision crew take out the eyes,
poke guys
the neck.
Out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's
is that
going to
be you, Brad? You're going to go for the
I
eyes?
I mean, look, man, if all my homies are on the line, the interesting question for me, now that John rattled some of that off, is, would you guys say that you have above or below the average will to live? I have above the...
I would say
I have above average will
think,
to live.
I think the
above,
average person will say that they have above average will to live.
Yeah. Yeah. This is like if you ask everyone, do you think you're a good or a bad driver, like above average driver, the vast majority of people will tell you that they're an above average driver. I feel like this is the exact same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. All right. That's great. Guys, this has been fantastic. Next week, we'll talk about whatever the weekly meta is. I think also something that I need to figure out, maybe you guys can help me, maybe the listeners of this podcast can help me. We need a name for this subject. I was thinking about Block Party. Seems really fucking generic. You can tell I just asked ChatGPT exactly what I should have called this. So if there's anyone out there with a possible name for whatever the show format is, hit me with it. And then also just give us the feedback. If you like this episode, what you want us to talk about. If you're in the Bankless Discord, at me there. If you're on Twitter, at us there. Andy, John, Brad, really appreciate you guys coming on and just talking through the week with me, and looking forward to doing it next week.
Later, dudes.
See ya.
It's fun. See ya.
Bankless Nation, you guys know the deal. Crypto is risky. You can lose what you put in. But nonetheless, we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we are glad you are with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.